You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
This is Brian Crosby from Walt Disney Imagineering, and you're listening to Mighty Marvel Geeks. Excelsior!
And welcome to another issue of Mighty Marvel Geeks here on Sorcerer Radio. I'm your host, Mike, and like I said last week, Ken's on vacation. He should be back hopefully next week, well-rested and hopefully still up to speed on his Marvel. Hopefully Hydra did not capture him while on vacation. That would be a bad thing. A lot to talk about this week. A bunch of X-Men news is probably going to take off this first half of the hour. The infamous Mighty Marvel Geeks 5 picks, when it's just me, are 6 picks of New Comic Book Day. Needless to say, it's the Mighty Marvel New Comic Book Day picks coming at you in the second half of the hour. Some news about Daredevil as well, and a little bit about, that favorite movie of ours, good old Fantastic Four. That's right. I got away with it. We talked about it, and we'll be bringing it up again. We're going to be discussing a little Fantastic Four. Jarvis must have been activated. Fantastic Jarvis. Please, can we try and do the Fantastic section without being censored?
For you, sir. Anything.
Well, thank you so much. To get right off the bat, X-Men. What a weekend. It's so far top movie for the month of May. I myself have not seen it yet, but I'm curious to. But there's a lot about the film. I'm curious to see how the overall acceptance of it is and how it ranks in line with all the others. And speaking of ranking, we have rated, this is from Yahoo Movies, how the X-Men movies, including Wolverine, he is an X-Men, but how we take those movies and how do they rank coming into X-Men Days of Future Past. Well, number 6 in the number 6 spot is X-Men The Last Stand, the movie that I guess is considered the embarrassment of the family. It is the black sheep. It was an ambitious entry, but also the weakest. Brett Ratner's foray into the franchise was laden with expensive and astonishingly inert action sequences and had the most impressive mutant cameos. Who could forget Omhyra as Arclight or Ken Luong as Spike Face Guy? Answer, everyone. The film's premise is a sound extension of the X-Men mythos. Xavier's disciples and Magneto's brotherhood of mutants face off over an inoculation that ends genetic mutation and, of course, threatens mutant kind. And, of course, the plot's heavy with melodrama surrounding Jean Grey's transformation into Phoenix. But the way they depict Phoenix's growing power accumulating in a tedious free-for-all battle on Alcatraz, kind of weak. In number 5 spot, we have the Wolverine. I don't know if I agree with this. This is the second Wolverine film, and it was a stunning diversion from the series in both style and substance, delving into the clawed superhero's past, introducing deeper conflicts and darker villains. The Wolverine also wisely relocates the character to an unfamiliar and exotic new locale, Tokyo, which, they did in the book, culminating in a balletic fight sequence rooted in samurai swordship. But Logan's inner turmoil prompted a brush of morality until he discovers that he could get back to his mutant self. Me, personally, I enjoyed the movie up until the point where, the one sword requires two hands for it to heat up and flame up. And then later we see Silver Samurai use just one hand, one sword, on the sword, and it flames up with no problem. Kind of a little bit of continuity error there. Overall, I thought it was a better film than X-Men Origins, but we'll go down the list and see where X-Men Origin lies. Well, looky there. X-Men Origins, number four. Origins comes close to being the great solo Wolverine story everyone had hoped for. Film traces Logan's origin back to childhood, presenting some fine whoopings along the way. And of course, you know, the beatdown of Will.i.am, who was portraying John Wraith. But the film's secret weapon is Liev Schreiber, who plays Logan's half-brother, Victor Creed, a.k.a. Sabretooth. Schreiber's portrayal was one of the delicious, sinister, yet sympathetic mutant is a welcome counterweight to Jackman's by-now tiresome brooding and scowling. Number three spot is the original X-Men. From Storm's slippery African accent to Toad's less-than-astonishing powers, a super tongue? Well, come on, it's Toad. You gotta understand there's more to the tongue than just the tongue. He is a toad, as a matter of fact. It was great intro into the series, and it kicked off a very lucrative thing that has become known as the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Now, of course, the first Spider-Man movie would arrive 2 years later in 2002. X-Men established the correlation between the plight of the mutants and the real-world prejudice that makes the franchise so relatable. While PG-friendly, flirtations between Rogue and Bobby Drake were forgettable, aimed for all four quadrants filler. The air crackled whenever Wolverine and Jean Grey were in the room together. Poor Cyclops. It also helped that Wolverine and his backstory hadn't been flogged by silly subsequent films. Number two spot, X-Men First Class. I agree with this. Since the franchise was rebooting and revolves around the graduates of a school for gifted children, it only makes sense that X-Men would occasionally reorient with the younger cast. Few people could have anticipated that the giddy kinetic energy created by the cast, with then rising star Michael Fassbender as tortured, misguided Magneto. Fassbender's internalization of Magneto's tragic backstory and vindictive rage nearly eclipsed the fine performances of James McAvoy as a younger Xavier and Jennifer Lawrence as the lissom Raven / Mystique. Granted, some of the minor characters were a bit flimsy, particularly the villains, but who needs proper bad guys when you have Fassbender's iron-like resolve as he slowly pushes a coin deep into Kevin Bacon's forehead. And then the number one movie of the X-Men franchise is X-Men United. X2 is not only the best of the X-Men franchise thus far, but it's also among the greatest comic book films ever made. Nightcrawler bamps into the White House. Stryker's men invade Xavier's school. Magneto dispatches a guard in a particularly gruesome fashion and escapes a glass prison. Anchored by three or four amazing set pieces and populated by a top-shelf fan-favorite characters flexing true mutant muscle, X2 strikes an ideal balance between action and story. Sure, there was more than Logan origin stuff to unearth, but at least he had to fight his way past the lovely Lady Deathstrike, to get to it. Though over a decade old, X2 still marks the spot. So where will X-Men Days of Future Past rank? Time will only tell. Now, let's talk about this end credit. Spoiler, if you haven't seen the movie, let's fast forward about 5 minutes and we should be out of it. Because I'm going to talk a little bit about the end credits, and I'm also going to talk a little bit about some Easter eggs in the film. So if you're listening to the podcast side, stop here, fast forward about 5-6 minutes, and we should be okay. If you're listening here on Sorcerer Radio, warning, spoiler alert, I'm just going to do it. That's why you listen to the show, is for that news, for that discussion. So, here we go. The end credits scene in Days of Future Past. It is a teaser for the next X-Men movie, which has already been talked about, X-Men Apocalypse. We see the beginning of what the character for Apocalypse is going to look like. Hopefully, this will turn into the next best story. At least Singer did definitely direct this post-credit scene, which is meant to introduce the upcoming villain, Apocalypse. He is, with the ancient Egyptian setting suggests Apocalypse would be jumping way back in time. Said that the sequence is truly meant as a tease for X-Men Apocalypse. Its story, its backstory, its history, for what will be the character of Apocalypse in the next film. It's not necessarily a part of the main story of the movie. And to update, BuzzFeed.com has learned that the actor portraying Apocalypse in the scene is a young newcomer named Brendan Petter, but he will probably not be the one portraying Apocalypse in X-Men, The Apocalypse. Those worshippers chanting Apocalypse's real name, in Sabah Nur, which means the first one, and indeed he is one of, if not the first mutant in human history. So we have a little bit of that tease there. One element that will probably make the movie are the Apocalypse's four horsemen, of course, his death, famine, pestilence, and war, which we see in the book as well. At his core, Apocalypse is an immensely powerful mutant, so much so that he seemingly cannot be killed, only diminished to the point that he must lay dormant for centuries or a millennia to regenerate. While rumors behind are abound of teenage versions of Cyclops, Storm, and Jean Grey appearing in X-Men Apocalypse, Simon Kinberg will not confirm their appearance at this time. So that we have now for X-Men, the info about the teaser scene, the Easter egg scene. Now, some Easter eggs that you might have missed in the movie. Kitty Pryde, time traveler. In the comic, Kitty Pryde, it was Kitty Pryde who went back in time, not Wolverine. But they, as a nod to this, though, they gave her time-phasing power so she could be the one who sends him back. The Maximoff family. When Quicksilver hears Magneto say that he can control metal, he says that his mother used to know somebody who could do just that. We also see the Maximoff family name on the mailbox outside of Quicksilver's home. This confirms that what we know, that Quicksilver, Pietro Maximoff, is Magneto's son. Another Easter egg that pops up in this movie, kind of unofficially, you see Scarlet Witch, maybe. Everyone's questioning whether the girl in the pink dress sitting on Pietro's lap is Wanda Maximoff. Some have said no, it's not. It's just revealing it's simply his younger sister. Of course, X-Men versus Avengers. This is a unique exception to the movie rights, as we've discussed before on the show. Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, both Fox and Marvel, are allowed to use them as they are both X-Men characters and Avenger characters. This means that, you know, Quicksilver will appear in the Avengers sequel, played by a completely different actor. We caught a glimpse of him and his sister in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, post-credits, but due to not being able to be referenced to Magneto, the X-Men, or mutants, they're simply called. Now, there are a couple cameos. We did not get a Stan Lee cameo in this one, but we did get two creators, or comic book writers, as a pair of U.S. senators. Chris Claremont, who wrote Days of Future Past and was the first guest on Mighty Marvel Geeks here on Sorcerer Radio, makes an appearance. And Lin Wen, who created Storm, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Wolverine, also makes an appearance. Finally, one last Easter eggs we're going to talk about. You can find the others online. The other Easter eggs, a couple other Easter eggs from X-Force Class. We see when Magneto goes to steal his helmet back, there's three other items from First Class. The coin Magneto used to kill Sebastian Shaw, Havoc's damaged harness, and one of Angel's insect wings. There are some fallen mutants in this, but I'm not going to release who they are because it's too much of a spoiler. And, of course, there is a timeline conflict involving Stryker. Stryker is a man who experimented on Wolverine and covered his bones with the sweet, sweet, unbreakable adamantium metal, as we learned in X-Men 2, X-Men United. But Stryker was also in X-Men Origins, Wolverine, which is where we first saw Wolverine and Stryker meet in Vietnam. But in Days of Future Past, Stryker is 20 years younger, doesn't know Wolverine, and Wolverine never mentions being in Vietnam. So the events of Origins and Days of Future Past overlap, creating a conflict in the timeline. If we had to choose which one would be the definitive version, I think we would all say we go with Days of Future Past. Who wouldn't? And then the last bit, Kitty and Colossus. sitting in a tree. Okay. Well, you the rest. At the end of the movie, we see at Xavier's school, we see a bunch of timeline fixes. We see a rare glimpse of a happy ending, like Jean and Scott coming back to life, Iceman and Rogue getting back together. And another couple we saw was Kitty Pryde and Colossus. This was never hinted at in the movies, but they had an amazing, long-lasting relationship in the comics, so it's a nice nod back to the comics there. So that's it for the Easter eggs in Days of Future Past. Now a little bit of trivia. How many of you caught as 20th Century Fox title card was fading to black that the X was the last thing to remain lit before it went completely black? Nice little tidbit there as a nod to the X-Men. In the comics, Days of Future Past takes place in 2013. Well, that's coincidentally when they started filming Days of Future Past, because in the movie it's now set in year 2023. Other little trivia. We see a homage to the Wolverine in this, when we're in his 1972 apartment. We see the samurai swords up on the wall and a photo of Mount Fuji adorning his walls. It's a clear sign of the character's new history. Again, the history's not that new. It's taken from an actual story arc from the comics. It bugs me when some of these other news sites write about it and they don't know some of the back history. So just a little bit there. So now it's been talked about as well that Stephen S. DeKnight will join Marvel's Daredevil. We are pleased to announce, according to Marvel, that acclaimed writer-director Stephen S. DeKnight from Spartacus, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Angel has joined Marvel's Daredevil as executive producer and showrunner on the all-new 13-episode series that will be premiering on Netflix in 2015. Drew Goddard, who also wrote the first two episodes, will continue to serve as well as executive producer on Daredevil, as he also is prepping to write Sony's The Amazing Spider-Man, the spinoff, The Amazing Spider-Man spinoff film, The Sinister Six. So stay tuned to Mighty Marvel Geeks for more information about Marvel's Daredevil coming to Netflix, such as how about Charlie Cox is also going to be portraying the man under the mask. He will be Matt Murdock. He's best known for his acclaimed work on Boardwalk Empire and Stardust. Cox will play Matt Murdock, the leading role in the new series. And of course, as we know, Daredevil is blinded as a young boy, but imbued with extraordinary senses. Matt Murdock fights against the injustice by day as a lawyer and by night as a superhero. All in a modern day Hell's Kitchen, New York City. So excited to see this. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break and, we'll see you on the other side.
Welcome to the new sound of Sorcerer Radio. Version 3.0.
Sorcerer Radio presents the Sorcerer Radio app, version 3.0. We have the technology. Check out our brand new Sorcerer Radio app for all iDevices as well as Android devices. Better, stronger, faster. Streaming Disney music 24/7. App highlights include a new broadcast window that shows you what you're listening to and what's coming up next.
Hot dog!
Multitasking so you can listen to SR as well as perform other tasks on your iPhone.
Gorge!
Listener access to all of our daily shows. The new interface, a new buffered stream, auto reconnect when signal is lost, visual EQ, pause, rewind, and scrub features.
My goodness!
And the new SR info area. Get your virtual Disney World fix today with the new Sorcerer Radio app, version 3.0 from Sorcerer Radio.
Be careful with that. It's extremely dangerous.
SRSounds.com.
Rebel Force Radio.
Your source for the Force.
Star Wars news and commentary.
With Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack.
I've seen Star Wars 500 times.
Weekly live shows and podcasts.
RFR.
Like Rebel Force Radio on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Rebel Force Radio.
Your new source for the Force.
Rebel Force Radio. With Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack. Saturdays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Sorcerer Radio. SRSounds.com.
Chip and Company is your daily Disney fix for Disney news, park planning, giveaways, and so much more. Visit our friends from Chip and Company at chipandco.com to get you up to date on all things Disney.
a magic beyond anything you could ever imagine.
Meet the Magic is a site where you can find Disney sites, blogs, and fun new Disney friends. Learn how to save money or make your trip more magical.
Prepare to have your senses awakened.
Visit meetthemagic.com and follow her on Twitter at meetthemagic, a proud partner of Sorcerer Radio.
It's an adventure too magical to miss.
Dan Barnes here, inviting you to take a ride with me on an all-new edition of E-Ticket Time. I'll be playing the best ride-through audio from all your favorite Walt Disney World attractions. No fast pass required here. Just tune in Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern, only on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com.
I am a Jedi, like my father before me.
Are you a fan of Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel? Well, look no further than JediMouseketeer.com. On this geeky fan site, you'll find the latest news, videos, information on movies, comics, and more. Check out JediMouseketeer.com and follow him on Twitter at JediMouseketeer, a proud partner of Sorcerer Radio.
Remember, the Force will be with you, always.
Getting ready for your next visit to Walt Disney World? Well, why not check out Disney Trip Tips Fridays at 1 p.m. on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com with me, Sandy Alexander. Disney favorites from the parks, resorts, movies, and TV, and the tips that the family and I have used on our many visits to Walt Disney World. And if you have any tips or photos you'd like to share, you can post them at the Disney Trip Tips Facebook page. You can even follow me on Twitter at Disney Trip Tips. Disney Trip Tips on Sorcerer Radio. All Disney music all day long. SR Sounds.
This is Joe Caramagna, writer and letterer at Marvel Comics, and you're listening to Mighty Marvel Geeks.
And welcome back to Mighty Marvel Geeks here on Sorcerer Radio. A lot of X-Men news at the front of the show. Now we're going to talk a little about some fancy-ass Jarvis, you said. Let's try this again. How about a little fancy-ass Jarvis? Jarvis. I thought you were going to allow me to say the name of that other show.
You are not authorized to access this area.
Excuse me, I have level 7. It says so on my cards. My shield ID card, remember? Let's try this again.
For you, sir, anything.
Alright. Fantastic Four. The Fantastic Four writer compares the new movie to rebooting Batman Begins or Iron Man. Writer-producer Simon Gimbert appears to be doing his best to quell skepticism about the Fantastic Four, going as far as drawing comparisons between the Fox franchise reboot and what may consider the paragons of modern superhero filmmaking. The tone of this movie will feel as unique as when you saw Iron Man, X-Men, or Batman Begins for the first time, he tells the Daily Beast. It is not as goofy as the first movies. It has humor in it, but the humor is much more real and comes from character, not pratfall jokes. It's much more of a dramatic film than it is a comedy. I would say it falls somewhere between Raimi's first couple Spider-Man movies and Chronicle. The core of the fans were not wild about the original movies, and nor was I, he admitted. Last summer, Emma Watts at Fox called me on the set of Days of Future Past and said, we really want to do a new Fantastic Four. I said to her, I'm interested, but it depends on how you want to do it. She said, talk to Josh Trank. We were shooting in the Washington, D.C. finale sequence of Days of Future Past, and I talked to Josh. And he had such a clear vision of what he wanted to do with the film that was so different from the other movies. It was grounded, real, gritty. And what it would really be like if you went through a transformation and lost control of your body. That coupled with him wanting it to be a coming-of-age film. It felt fresh. So I think it's a little bold to be comparing it to Batman Begins or an Iron Man movie. I still have my skepticism about the Fantastic Four, as you hear, as I always joke with the censor beeps. I don't know. I'm hoping the new one tends to be better, because it would be great to kind of see him tie in with X-Men and Apocalypse if that happens. But right now, I'm having my doubts. Now, we also know last week Ant-Man's Edgar Wright was pretty much let go by Marvel. But was Marvel right in doing so? Marvel is kind of right about Ant-Man. here's where we go. This is what the world of cinematic art and commerce has come to. The complete reversal of long-standing critical analysis that says filmmakers are always right when they stand up for their creative vision, and the studios are always wrong when they prioritize the bottom line. But the bottom line in this case isn't entirely about money. It's mostly about money, maybe even 99% about money. But if we're being honest, there's more to the story than Edgar Wright is right and Marvel Studios is wrong. There's also us, the fans, who literally beg for this to happen and who now have to accept a certain amount of responsibility for robbing the world of an Edgar Wright Ant-Man movie and giving Marvel Studios the moral authority to let it go for what they can realistically call the greater good. An important part of the storytelling is deciding where the story begins. Perhaps it began this week when the pressures of meeting Marvel Studios' demands for a homogenized superhero franchise drove Edgar to leave the director's chair for Ant-Man, a movie scheduled to release barely a year from now, on July 17, 2015. Or perhaps maybe 8 years ago, when Edgar Wright agreed to make Ant-Man in the first place. How about maybe that time when Marvel Studios announced its very existence and proceeded to slow walk Wright's motion picture for nearly a decade, giving him time to make 3 features in the interim and develop even more so as an artist as he waited for the green light. But the story probably began many years earlier. Nobody knows exactly how many, but when the first comic book superhero enthusiasts publicly declared that they wanted superhero movies to connect to one another, and that's when, moments later, a like-minded individual enthusiastically agreed. A cascade began at that moment, largely ignored by movie studios around the world, in which superhero fans found themselves openly begging Hollywood to take Marvel and DC's leads. Let multiple superheroes exist within the same continuity. Let Superman and Batman team up. We bellowed in unison. Would you rather settle for a brief mention of Metropolis and Batman Forever? Warner Brothers replied. Of course, the fans said no. But we let it go because we had no control whatsoever over their decisions. Superhero movies were being made for general audiences, and general audiences the studios believed didn't care what the serious geeks like us thought. But as the superhero movies evolved and the geek revolution, as I say over on Weeby Geeks, started at the turn of the century, turned into one of the more dominant genres in the entertainment industry, holding studios aloft with massive merchandise profits. And gradually fewer and fewer exceptions making tons of money at the box office, the landscaping changed. The idea of a cohesive superhero universe was suddenly an economically viable idea, with Marvel Studios now owning the rights to most of their popular heroes. They announced a plan to let them coexist on screen. Fans cheered when Nick Fury mentioned the Avengers at the end of 2008's Iron Man, and they turned out in mass for 2012's Avengers. Now, what did it take for us to get exactly what we wanted? Enormous corporate oversight. It took the studio executives, the very kind we'd like to demonize whenever something goes wrong, doing their jobs for a positive end for a change. Now, these movies, based on the adventures of Iron Man, the Hulk, Captain America, and Thor, have been homogenized because that's exactly what we wanted. That's exactly what we've been praising to various degrees every time they come out. We've outwardly been thankful for Marvel Studios' effort and outwardly resentful of Warner Brothers. Hence why this is Mighty Marvel Geeks, not We Be Warner Brothers, for not following suit on their own superhero universe. Since they own the complete library of DC Comics, it's hypocritical of us to say that prioritizing Ant-Man's place in the greater Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU, over a single director's creative vision is the wrong thing to do, since we've been giving them billions of dollars to do that very thing. And ever since, every year, we still find ourselves asking for more. Now, none of us know for a fact if Ant-Man's going to be any good, or if it would have been better with Edgar Wright in the director's chair. It's just like saying, would David Lynch's Return of the Jedi been better than the Return of the Jedi that we had? What we do know is Edgar Wright is a rare talent, a highly distinctive and meaningful voice for a new generation whose films have uniquely transformed seemingly superficial pop culture concerns into profound examinations of the way we live and interpret the events of our lives. Shaun of the Dead, one of the best movies of the 2000s, used tropes of zombie genre to illustrate the growth from arrested adolescence into maturity. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, one of the best films of the 2000s. 2010s used tropes of video games, amongst other pop phenomena, to illustrate personal and interpersonal growth as a series of literal battles for self-worth against our own histories and the ways others judge us based on our personal baggage. But Marvel Studios doesn't like that. They don't make complex motion pictures full of rich allegories. They make broad, universally relatable fables in which fun characters and superpowers overcome the odds. All odds. Sometimes even the screenplays are clever. Usually the movies are extremely entertaining, but the closest they've ever come to being daring besides the purely structural conceit of allowing superheroes to team up in the first place was Captain America the Winter Soldier, when Cap turned against America's corrupt politicians. Even when they hedged their bets by saying that the government itself wasn't responsible for many of the evils that have been afflicted, it was secret super Nazis all along. Is Edgar Wright wise to leave? Probably. A bona fide blockbuster under his belt might have benefited him down the line from a business perspective, but as a general artist, the amount of time he would have to spend making a motion picture that he would not have been happy with could have proven frustrating and detrimental. Frankly, after spending 8 years in development on Ant-Man and seeing the direction that Marvel Studios had been taking over that period of time, we should be surprised he hadn't jumped ship much earlier. Is Marvel Studios wise in letting him go? Probably. They hired a director to make a film within the framework of a financially and critically successful franchise. And if that director wasn't going to be happy to fulfill those duties, then they probably would be wise to find another. The only thing is, in this unique situation, is that Edgar Wright and co-writer Joe Cornish developed the screenplay themselves. And that the perception, accurate or otherwise, amongst the fan and his pundits, is that Ant-Man himself is a minor concern to the Marvel Studios. An ancillary character whose cinematic adventures only intrigued their fans because Edgar Wright was attached to the film in the first place. But the film has been cast, the release date announced, and the chain of events is probably too far gone to cancel the film now, even if that were the case. Edgar Wright has the support of many fans as one of the most talented filmmakers of this generation, or his generation, who has every right to make a film the way he wants to. Marvel Studios, as much as it pains most to say, based on decades of film criticism principles that demand we say the opposite, also has our support for adhering to corporate mentality that, for once, is giving us fans everything we ask for. For better or for worse, We had no way of knowing that what we were asking Marvel to deny a great artist the right to make the movie that he wanted. But that's exactly what we did, and now we're going to have to accept the consequences. It's our own culpability. So, who's to blame in this? Marvel? Edgar Wright? Us, the fans? I think we're all to blame. And we're all not to blame. So, we put out there what we wanted from Edgar. We put out there what we wanted from Marvel. We put out what we wanted out there as fans. And now we're just going to have to wait and see. Now, Marvel is teasing us with the next event in comic world for this summer, or for this fall. And it's called Axis. It will follow the original Sin story event that's going on right now. And Axis was first announced at C2E2. The Chicago Comic and Entertainment Expo, with little information to draw from. First, the logo was teased, which featured iconic symbols for the Avengers and the X-Men, signifying another event that will combine the two heroic sides of the Marvel Universe. The last time this happened was in a climactic event known as Avengers vs. X-Men, which promised to change the landscape of the Marvel Universe forever. It kind of did that, and today we will see a new mixture of teams and characters that affect the status quo. Original Sin has been touted as more of a Marvel-wide event instead of focusing on specific teams, but it looks like Axis will return to the success of AVX by focusing on the X-Men and the Avengers. The next teaser we saw coming came from the cover of Diamond's June previews, which featured an Axis-drawn image drawn by Jim Chung. The cover includes a new logo that is also an ambigram, meaning it could be read the same turned upside down, which is pretty cool. The first image featuring an interesting roster of villains, including Red Onslaught, who we first saw in Uncanny Avengers number 4. The other villains include Green Goblin, Loki, Sabretooth, Doctor Doom, and Carnage. The latest complimentary image from Jim Chung appeared on a New York City transit poster advertising next month's special edition New York City Convention, where we could assumedly expect more details on Axis. This teaser poster features some of the most interesting heroes that we could possibly expect to face off against the villains previously teased. Although it isn't actually confirmed as an Axis image, but it is very similar in style to the previous Axis trailer. The transit poster features Storm, Thor, Iron Man, Luke Cage, Deadpool, and Medusa, which raises far more questions than it answers at this point. Is this a team of heroes that we will follow in Axis, or merely a representation of some of the characters who will appear? A few years ago, the Avengers vs. X-Men teasers featured a number of characters together who did not meet up to battle in the event itself, so it might be too early to speculate on what appearances these characters mean. However, we can't expect Axis to unfold from the events of Rick Remender's Uncanny Avengers series, which itself is something of a continuation of Remender's Uncanny X-Force series. The Uncanny Avengers team has operated pretty independently from the rest of the Marvel Now universe, so it'll be interesting to see them taking the lead in this new event. More news is developing over the next few months, so look to the ongoing Original Sin event for possible more clues to Axis. And of course, we will bring you more of that here on Mighty Marvel Geeks. So, it's that time, it's that moment, and it is Mighty Marvel Geeks picks for New Comic Book Day, which will be for June 4th, 2014. First book on the list, The Amazing X-Men Annual Number 1. Storm and the Amazing X-Men go to Africa. A death in Storm's family sheds light on a new threat to the X-Men. Number 2 pick, written by Cary Andrews. Cover artist is also Cary Andrews. It's Iron Fist, The Living Weapon. Number 3, Kunlun in Ruins. Ninja Nurses versus Killers in Suits. Our villain's face revealed, and it's one terribly close to Danny Rand's heart. Third pick of the week, Captain America number 21. Written by Rick Remender. Cover artist is Nick Klein. This is it, the one you don't want to miss. The beginning of the end of Steve Rogers. The iron nail breaks Captain America. Steve Rogers lays a final sacrifice on the altar of freedom. Number 4 pick of the week, Miles Morales, Ultimate Spider-Man number 2. Part 2 of the greatest Spider-Man story of the year, Revival. After the mind-blowing reveal at the end of the first issue, Miles' life will never be the same again. With S.H.I.E.L.D. gone, the biggest villain in Spider-Man history is out, and nothing can stop him. Miles has made a huge choice about the woman he loves. Will he regret it? Last pick, Magneto number 5. It's written by Cullen Bunn. Cover artist is Declan Shalvey. Magneto continues his crusade of safeguarding the future of mutant kind by whatever means he deems necessary, all the while pursued by agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But now someone new is hot on the trail of the Master of Magnetism, someone with ties to his past. Will she be his greatest ally, or his downfall, or both? So interesting to see what's coming from there. Now, there was one more story I was going to bring up. It's gone both directions. Yes, he is. No, he isn't. And that's Hugh Jackman is talked about retiring or having from Wolverine. He came out and added stuff for X-Men's Future Past. Okay, I'm hanging up. And okay, and you've done 7 films. It's quite a bit of work to do so. Now, over at cinemablend.com, our friends there, the article from the column Monday Movie Month, Kids Story on Memorial Day, saying it's time for Hugh Jackman to hang up. From that article, he goes on to preface this by saying that I love Hugh Jackman. This would be Sean O'Connell. Let me preface this by saying I love Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. And his portrayal of the legendary mutant in X-Men Days of Future Past, love him. His turn in X-Men is his best yet. Even I said that in my review of the movie. However, it's time for him to walk away from the role that helped put him on the map. And I'll explain why in this memo. And he says, watching the video above. He kind of gets into, you know, seven episodes, you know, essentially seven movies. You know, maybe at this point in time we're tired of seeing them hanging up. Well, Jackman was considering it. Now he reconsiders his retirement. This is a quote from Jackman at the world premiere. At one point, you're right. I said I was pretty sure about leaving the role, but I'm less sure as it goes on, because after seeing this movie, the whole thing feels fresher to me than ever. And during this movie, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's kind of a clean slate, so who knows where we're going to go. As long as I have a passion for it and the fans will have me, I will continue. Essentially, he's saying he'll continue on. That's genuine Hugh Jackman right there. Always thinking of what the fans want and need. Hey, Hollywood, take notes, okay? And even your actor is suggesting what you should do. Do you want him to continue or not? It's going to be interesting to see how the fans truly take this particular announcement. Bringing as of the time of this recording, Sin City actor joins the Marvel Cinematic Universe as the ultimate villain. The stage has been set for months, and almost all of the major players have been moved into place for the summer's Guardians of the Galaxy, except for one. The Mad Titan himself, Thanos, has shown up. The Avengers have been teased in a handful of other films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We know he's going to be a part of the Guardians, so where has he been in the trailers and the stills? Well, finally now, we have our man. Word on the street, or the internet street, that is, and
A lot of
sites are taking this as a grain of salt. I'm going to tell you, I'm still a little unsure until I actually see it come from Marvel themselves, which I'm checking right now. But they're saying Latino Review is saying Josh Brolin is taking the role of Thanos. Now, this is still yet to be confirmed by Marvel or Brolin's reps, so please take this with a grain of salt. Checking now on Marvel's site, I am not seeing anything from them about it. So again, it's Latino Review. I myself started to fall victim to it, as you heard with me saying, you know, breaking news right now, until I saw that it's Latino Review that's reporting this. I'm not a big fan of what they're doing. They're trying. There's a lot out there that Latino Review has been proved wrong on a lot of stuff, yet they're still trying to pawn off everything. They're trying to be the TMZ of the geek world. That's all I got to say. But if they are right in this, then Marvel's hit another home run by casting Brolin. There are a few actors out there who are hotter right now, particularly in his age range. And Brolin has coveted a number of intense, gripping roles over the last few years. He's coming off a criminally underrated performance in Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy. We will see him in the upcoming Frank Miller's Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Basically, he's made a career in the past being a major villain, and he'd be fantastic in this role. But then again, I've also heard Schwarzenegger tossed out in this role. There was someone else tossed out earlier today as well that supposedly was from the words of Latino Review. Brolin has the voice, he has the experience, he has the depth and the talent to bring something fantastic to the role, if it is even limited screen time in Guardians, if this is true. So, take it with a grain of salt, like I said, with Latino Review. It has been my pleasure to give you the Marvel news for this week. I am Mike. You can catch me on Twitter at MarvelGeeks. If you want to email the show, it's show@weebiegeeks.net. Until next time, thank you for listening to Sorcerer Radio. Check out all the other shows during the week that you'll find on weekdays that replay, you know, morning shows that replay later in the evening, from Sorcom Review to DW60 to WDW Tiki Room to E-Ticket Time, and more. So check them out. We thank you for being a part of the Sorcerer Radio family. And until next week.
This has been a Weebie Geeks production.